Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Would that we could all be in Jackson Hole, Wyoming this week, huh? Fresh air, beautiful scenery, and hour after hour of macroeconomic policy discussions. What could possibly be better than that? Well, lots, of course, but we're a show about business and the economy, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 20th of August. Today, it's a Wednesday. Great, as always, to have you with us. Janet Yellen and the gang, that is her colleagues from the Federal Reserve and academic economists from far and wide, will gather in Jackson Hole starting tomorrow for the annual Economic Policy Symposium put on by the Kansas City Fed. It is a much-anticipated conference, this one is. Ben Bernanke used it just a couple of years ago to hint at the Fed's plans for quantitative easing, the end of which is much on Wall Street's radar right now, because the fact is that the central bank just ain't what it used to be. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith gets us going.
You could say during the recession, the Federal Reserve went from a mild-mannered Clark Kent to an ultra-proactive super Fed. Edwin Truman is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Its job was fairly narrowly defined to focus on inflation. But in the crisis, they ended up using tools that had not been used since the 1930s and inventing a whole bunch of new tools.
Tools like quantitative easing, where the Fed started pumping $85 billion into the economy every month.
I do think that the bank has fundamentally changed.
Economist Jared Bernstein was a member of President Obama's economic team. He says the central bank went from reactive to proactive. And he says it's now looking like it will get even more proactive under Federal Reserve Chief Janet Yellen, stepping into an oversight role.
When Chair Janet Yellen says, "I don't think the Fed has the luxury of ignoring bubbles in financial markets," that's different from either of her last two predecessors.
And even if Yellen wanted to retire the red cape, she'd find it hard.
You're not going to put the genie back in the bottle.
Again, the Peterson Institute's Edwin Truman.
It creates what we economists call a moral hazard. So if things get in trouble, the Federal Reserve will ride to the rescue.
Truman says now that the central bank has flexed its monetary muscles to save the U.S. economy and maybe even the world, no one will ever look at the mild-mannered Fed the same way again. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Uber, the ride-sharing company that has upended the taxi industry, has a new vice president and strategist. It's former Obama campaign operative David Plouffe, which at first glance might seem curious because Uber has been unabashed in its fight against transportation regulations and taxi unions, things you wouldn't necessarily think a longtime Democratic strategist would be embracing. Strange? Meet bedfellow. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports.
A few weeks ago, the Republican National Committee started sending out an email petition with the headline, "Why We Need Uber." It touts the company as a perfect example of GOP free market ideals.
So we did an op-ed in the Chicago Tribune. We had the petition. You know, it's doing our part to raise awareness.
Kirsten Kakowski is press secretary for the RNC. She says when Uber announced yesterday it's hiring a top Democratic strategist,
well, I think we were a little shocked.
Jeff Berry, a professor of political science at Tufts University, was not shocked. Plouffe will be joining a company that venture capitalists recently valued at more than $18 billion. So for one thing,
ka-ching, there's a lot of money that David Plouffe is going to make as a strategist.
But he says there are other more strategic reasons that Democrats might want to be associated with an innovative tech business like Uber.
This actually gives the Democrats an opportunity to identify with a deregulatory environment, one in which entrepreneurs are free to develop new ideas and new businesses.
Even if that alienates some local taxi driver unions and companies, and people like Ramzi Rege, an Uber driver in San Francisco. He leads a network of Uber drivers pushing for better worker protections.
That's what the Democrats ought to do, and that's what the Republicans ought to do. You can support Uber, but you can also make it right at the same time.
Meanwhile, it finally seems that many prominent Democrats and Republicans have found something they can agree on. They love Uber. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
To cap off the top of the news today, Bank of America, the Associated Press reports B of A has agreed to a $17 billion settlement with state and federal regulators over its mortgage misdeeds during the financial crisis, a settlement that was rumored a couple of weeks ago. It comes after J.P. Morgan paid $13 billion in a similar deal. Citigroup paid about $7 billion, which means we're about done with the fallout from the financial crisis, right? Right? Yeah, no. Wall Street Today, onward and upward. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tax policy is, in the most objective sense, a wonderful thing. It lets governments encourage or discourage certain kinds of behavior. Case in point, movies. 15 years ago, only 4 states gave tax credits as a way to get production companies to come to town. Now, almost 40 states do. Problem is, and this isn't just movie companies at all, but the problem is a lot of businesses don't rack up enough of a tax bill to actually use the tax credits they get. So, of course, now the market for selling those credits is growing as well. Kate Davidson reports.
To show you how sophisticated the market for buying and selling state tax credits has grown, let's follow the path of an incentive named
BETSI, which stands for Business Energy Tax Credit.
BETSI is from Oregon, which said to businesses, invest in renewable energy or conservation, and we'll give you this tax credit. Our BETSI's story starts at the Port of Portland. This economic hub relies on a dredge, the Dredge Oregon, to clear navigation channels. Its gas-guzzling engine was decades old, says Tatiana Starostina, the port's senior finance manager.
It wasn't particularly environmentally friendly.
So the port invested in this new engine, which helped cut emissions, but also cost a lot. So the port got a BETSI from the state, which just left one wrinkle.
Well, because the port is a government entity, obviously we cannot use the tax credit to its original purpose.
The port doesn't pay taxes, so a tax credit doesn't do much good unless the port can monetize it.
Monetize means we literally sell it to them?
To an outside company at a discount. And that company gets to use the full tax credit.
It would be like a Groupon.
This is the man the port asked to sell BETSI.
My name is Rob O'Neill. I'm a partner with Moss Adams. We have helped facilitate the transfer of over $500 million in state tax credits.
O'Neill says the secondary market for tax credits is absolutely growing. By some estimates, there are up to 200 state tax credits that are transferable or directly cashable. Companies are selling film credits, credits for historic preservation, job creation, renewable energy, farm worker housing. But O'Neill says until now, the market's been a bit of a black box.
A lot of people were calling tax directors and CFOs and people they meet on the golf course and try and sell them a tax credit. And no one really had transparency with respect to the market.
Now O'Neill prepared to list BETSI on a brand new digital exchange, kind of like a Craigslist of tax credits. Click on Oregon and you'd see BETSI, a $647,000 credit available for 74 cents on the dollar. But at the last minute, BETSI sold the old-fashioned way. O'Neill got a call from
a large public transportation equipment manufacturer,
which he described on the condition it not be named. Still, O'Neill wants to nudge more tax credit business online. Moss Adams is one of at least half a dozen companies starting private exchanges, and there's a new public exchange, too.
Everything's moving to the web, and so I think it's just a matter of time before the business community starts to accept that, this is the way credits will transfer, in the future.
Meanwhile, a company with almost $2 billion in revenue gets a deal on a tax credit. The Port of Portland gets to use BETSI's proceeds for its dredge. Oregon achieves its energy efficiency goal, although it does lose more than $500,000 in tax revenue from a business that might not need public help. And that's just from the path of one little tax credit in a market of incentives worth billions. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Just because there's not enough to watch on your television dial already, and yes, I know it's a cable box on top of the TV, not a dial, but work with me here, will you? Anyway, just because there's not enough to watch, how about every single episode of The Simpsons ever in chronological order in one 12-day Simpsons-palooza? If that's your thing, you're going to want to make sure your cable company offers the fledgling FXX network, which last year spent $1 billion for the syndication rights to what is, believe it or not, the longest-running scripted series in American television history. This is the long-awaited move of Bart and the gang to cable, and FXX is clearly hoping the $1 billion is going to pay off. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
Tomorrow, FXX will start airing its first Simpsons marathon with 552 episodes. In the fall, FXX will run the shows regularly and launch an app with special digital access. It's enough to impress the most stalwart of Simpsons fans.
Yeah, and I'm not easily impressed. Wow, a blue car!
The Simpsons move to cable was highly anticipated and likely drew lots of bids. The winner, FXX, is another unit of the same parent company, 21st Century Fox. Tuna Amobi is an equity analyst with S&P Capital IQ. He says FXX just launched last fall with the goal of reaching 18 to 34-year-olds, and the Simpsons rights are a big deal for it.
For FXX, it's almost like a coup to help them to, you know, create an identity early on.
Jonathan Taplin directs the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California. He thinks the FXX strategy to curate Simpsons shows online is inspired.
Because it will allow the fans to really see whatever they want, whenever they want it, on whatever device they want.
Sam Craig, director of the Entertainment Media and Technology Program at New York University, says the ultimate goal is to get viewers hooked onto other FXX shows.
If The Simpsons can't do it, it's a question of what else is out there that can.
But Craig says given the FXX target audience, betting on The Simpsons is probably pretty smart. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Here's another show business item in which the National Football League gets quite possibly a little bit too big for its britches. You know how the halftime show at the Super Bowl is always a big deal? Well, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that not only is the NFL going to keep on not paying musicians to play at the big game, the exposure is reward enough, the thinking goes. Now the league is asking potential halftime acts to pay for the privilege. Sally Herships has more.
There are three finalists for next year's Super Bowl show: Katy Perry, Coldplay, and Rihanna. They're already huge. So is it worth it for them to pay to perform?
I think it probably is worth it, to be honest with you.
Bill Wordy is an entrepreneur at Guggenheim Digital and former editor of Billboard magazine.
Even when you're an established artist, the lift that you get from playing this halftime show is undeniable.
Wordy says you can raise ticket prices and get bigger and better brand sponsorships worth millions. Victor Matheson teaches economics at the College of the Holy Cross. He says even if this year's finalists won't pay, the NFL could still ask other musicians to. After all, it has a monopoly on halftime.
Sure, you can come up with a list pretty quickly of other folks who might be willing to pay a little bit of money to, you know, have their act featured on a show that over 100 million people are watching.
But maybe fans shouldn't get to watch the NFL's negotiations.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, listen, I promise you that there are people in the head office of the NFL on a witch hunt right now trying to figure out how this news got out there.
Wordy says musicians want their music in the spotlight, not their negotiations. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So I'm waiting for when people want the real thing again, and that's when you'll start hearing my hits again.
Record producer and songwriter Linda Perry. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials held on to a 59-point gain today after the Federal Reserve released minutes from its last meeting that added up to, Yeah, no big news. The Dow was up 0.3%, closed at 16,979. The NASDAQ was flat, 45.26. The S&P 500 added 4 points, about 0.25%, 1986. You've heard about the millions of American cars under recall, right? Now imagine you were a company that relied on lots and lots of American cars. Say you were, I don't know, Hertz. Hertz said it will miss its profits forecast due to recalls and other factors, dropped 4% today. Moving on note, Steve Ballmer severed his last official tie with Microsoft yesterday. Shares off 0.8% today. Remember, though, correlation is not causation, y'all. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. City for sale signs disappear on your block. The National Association of Realtors releases existing home sales from the month of July. On Wall Street, Gap Inc. reports earnings. Besides the company's eponymous line, Gap Inc. runs Old Navy and Banana Republic. And for U.S. history buffs, on this day in 1959, President Eisenhower welcomed Hawaii as the 50th state of the Union. Aloha. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you take a virtual stroll through the iTunes Store or Google Play, you will find nearly 100,000 health apps, fitness trackers and blood glucose monitors and almost anything in between. But out of all of them, only 100 or so have been cleared by the Food and Drug Administration. Lauren Silverman reports now from KERA in Dallas.
Nathan Cortez went to law school in Silicon Valley. He wears a Nike Fitbit bracelet, and his iPhone is stocked with apps like Symptom Checker and WebMD. But others scare him.
I've got an app you can use to record your heartbeat or bowel sounds or other sounds, lung sounds, and it spits out a diagnosis. Just the thought that you can hold your cell phone up to your chest and receive a potentially serious diagnosis of a cardiac problem is a little mind-blowing.
Cortez is now a law professor at SMU in Dallas, and while he talks about hypothetical dangers, there are real-life examples of malfunctioning apps. Take a rheumatoid arthritis app by Pfizer.
It was basically a calculator trying to calculate a score for how severe your rheumatoid arthritis is, and it wasn't working. And doctors, who knows how many doctors were using this app. In that case, you may have seen treatment decisions being made based on erroneous calculations.
Or the blood glucose app drug company Sanofi recalled because it was miscalculating insulin doses. Right now, the FDA categorizes apps on three levels of risk. It only has jurisdiction over the riskiest products and doesn't review all of those. Why? Cortez says it's mainly politics and the fear of stifling innovation. As Virginia Congressman Morgan Griffith put it recently on Capitol Hill, more regulation could drive developers to stop focusing on medical apps and create games instead.
So they're more likely to try to find the next angry bird as opposed to finding the next angry mole.
The FDA hopes to avoid the wrath of angry entrepreneurs. This month, the agency announced even more exemptions for mobile health products that allow users to track, log, and share data with doctors. Under those rules, Apple's HealthKit, an app to track everything from blood pressure to lung capacity, is free from regulation. But Mike Bartlett's app, which tracks retinal diseases like macular degeneration, did require FDA clearance.
We believe that a regulatory approved medical app costs you about 10 times as much and takes about 10 times as long as doing one that's not regulated.
Bartlett organized multiple months-long clinical studies of his company's app called My Vision Track. It was arduous and expensive. He says that's the way it should be.
I would be scared to death using a medical app that addressed a serious condition, and having a retinal disease that's causing you to go blind is very serious, believe me. And we know for a fact there are vision tests that are available on the iPhone store today that absolutely don't work. Apps only seem to have brought all the snake oil salesmen out of the woodwork now.
Regulators are walking a fine line between letting the snake oil salesmen roam free and discouraging legitimate investors. Chuck McCoy is head of North Texas Angels Network. He says so far, investors aren't complaining about too much sticky red tape.
The FDA overregulates in many areas. But if you are going to, in fact, make clinical claims about a device, there has to be some scientific basis for those claims.
Many entrepreneurs agree that the FDA overregulates medical devices. Now, some say it's underregulating mobile health apps. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Back in 1993, this song peaked at number 14 on the Billboard charts.
In
That's a band called Four Non Blondes and a song that is called, despite the lyrics, What's Up, with Linda Perry on lead vocals. She didn't end up sticking with the band, but Linda Perry did stick around the music business, producing and songwriting for the likes of Gwen Stefani, Pink, and Christina Aguilera. She has now taken her talents to television, a show on VH1 called Make or Break, the Linda Perry Project, which shows what Perry calls the actual music business as opposed to American Idol and The Voice. She's got studios out in North Hollywood, really cool studios, I might add. So the other day, we went over for a chat.
I have a bunch of guitars that I've collected since my career, and I have a 1953 gold top right there, which started this whole party.
Is that a special guitar?
It's a really special guitar. It's the first guitar I bought with my first money ever made from Four Non Blondes. That guitar is worth a lot of money now.
And all these drums along
the
wall?
And I love drums. I'm fascinated. I find them extremely sexy. And then there was this ugly wall right behind you that was a soundproof wall that, you know, some guy, you know, made it for sonic, you know, reasons, tuning. It was the first thing that went away. It was the most ugly thing I've ever seen. And they were like, you can't do that. It's for tuning. And I'm like, well, put up a big bookshelf. That'll be tuning enough, you know. And so I like it because it reminds me that I'll never be empty for words, because every word that I need is right here behind me in these books.
This is basically your office. I mean, you spend your working day here.
I'm here all the time. And I appreciate it every single morning. I say thank you for this.
When did you discover that you were, I don't know, because it's pretty clear here you're a producer at heart now. I mean, this is your thing. When did you make that realization? Because you were big for a while in the performing world.
Yeah, I felt like when I left Four Non Blondes to go discover things about who I wanted to be. I mean, I didn't really know. I got in this band and then poof, literally it was a poof, you know, that we sold 7 million records, toured all over the place, and then I'm locked into these guys. Wait a minute. Hold on. I just signed up for, you know, this record. I was very green. I didn't understand the whole, you know, you're married for life. I wasn't committed like that, you know. And so when I left the band and I kind of dibbled on my own, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh, I can write songs for other people, and then I don't have to go out there into the cruel world, you know.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because since you left Four Non Blondes and you've been, you know, you've founded record labels and you produce for other artists, this is going to sound worse than I mean it to, but there's an instability to this business that you've chosen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that phase you at all?
Well, honestly, I don't feel ever very successful, because I haven't had a hit in a while, because I don't search for them.
Yeah, but come on.
Right. But let me explain it, how my brain works. All right. To be where I am right now, I love it. I love writing songs, but I don't want to write the songs people are asking me to write. Mm-hmm. I get people coming, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this tempo. Mm-hmm. And I'm like looking at them going, well, then you got the wrong person, because I don't do that. So I'm waiting for when people want the real thing again. And that's when you'll start hearing my hits again.
Do you think business is too big a part of the music industry? And I know that sounds kind of silly, but...
Well, I think we can say that kind of across the board about everything. I mean, movies, everything. Music is a business. When you watch American Idol and The Voice, that is a business. I mean, there's Pepsi, there's Coca-Cola, there's all this money, there's all this advertisement. But doesn't all this stuff happen all the time and then we go back? I mean, it's kind of a cycle. I think things get greedy, things get crazy, music gets shitty, movies start, you know, too many blockbusters, they start losing the plot, blah, 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 we complain, independents show up, there's going to be some girl that's going to sell a million records out of the trunk of her car, you know what I mean? The 60s will come back, you know, it'll all just start over, and then the next time it'll be even bigger. The business is just a part of what we have to go through in life. Think about that.
Does it bother you then that you will be known for a long time for that one song that you made big?
No, I mean, millions of people try to get that one song. That one song, that one hit wonder created an incredible empire.
Is that what you have? You have an empire?
I do have an empire.
But here comes the hypothetical question. If this goes away tomorrow, if the books and the piano and this gazillion-dollar studio and the microphones and all of that goes away tomorrow, and you find yourself playing guitar in a coffee bar in San Francisco, you still all right?
Oh, my God, I'm more than all right. I've been in a coffee bar in San Francisco. I've lived out in a park, you know, sleeping on the grass with no place to go. I've not eaten. I've been there. There's nothing you could do to me. There's nothing you could take away from me that would make me feel like I wasn't going to be all right. I would just start all over again. I know me, I would be afraid. I'm scared. I'm scared of losing my wife and family. I'm scared of losing my mom. But it doesn't dictate my decisions and choices. And if I lost it all, I would be super bummed, man. But I would just get it all back.
Does that make you better at what you do?
No, it just makes me a survivor.
Make or Break, The Linda Perry Project, airs tonight on VH1. Pictures, of course, of that awesome studio of hers on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a tad wonky but cool, I think. A map from the Tax Foundation, that's a Washington think tank specializing in, yes, tax policy. Anyway, the map shows you how much stuff you can buy for $100 in each state as compared to how much stuff you can buy for $100 as a national average. $100 is worth the least in Washington, D.C., $84.60. It's worth the most in Mississippi, $115.74. Again, that's as compared to the national average. All right, holy cow, look at the time we got to go. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.